As a child, Katie Royfe was frequently sick and hospitalized, and in the wake of a near-death experience, her fascination with death began. In her new book, The Violet Hour, Royfe takes an unexpected approach to the most unavoidable of subjects by studying the final days of six great writers: Susan Sontag, Sigmund Freud, John Updike, Dylan Thomas, Maurice Sendak, and James Salter. As she writes of her subjects, "I'm writing about deaths, not the deaths of people I loved, but of writers and artists who are especially sensitive or attuned to death." Again, the title of the book is The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End, and we welcome Katie Royfe to the roundtable this morning. Katie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What brought you to want to look at great writers at the end of their lives?
Well, it's a strange subject. I started to think about that subject when I was young. I almost died when I was 12. I stopped breathing in a taxi on the way to the emergency room, and the taxi driver carried me into the hospital, and they put oxygen. And for the next year, I was very, very ill. And I was convinced that I was dying. And since that time, I've been very interested in, maybe obsessed by, the idea of how we confront mortality.
To take that a step further of confronting mortality, but in your book, specifically writers, what did you find interesting about that?
Well, I thought that it would be useful to look at people who have very vast and kind of amazing imaginations, who would be able to put this idea of the approach of death into words in a way that other people can't. So I was really looking for people who would be able to kind of express this very difficult, taboo, kind of unwieldy, inexpressible topic in words. And so that is why I was drawn to writers.
When it came down to the actual writers that you chose in studying the final days, what were you looking for as far as criteria?
It wasn't so much a matter of criteria. I chose people who were very interested in and engaged with the idea of illness and death for their entire lives, who had basically given the subject a lot of thought and were working through it in one way or another in their poems, in their art, in their thinking. So I chose people who had a special interest. And then it was really an instinct. I gravitated toward writers who I felt I kind of had this feeling that there was something in their writing and that would lead to some kind of knowledge or illumination. So it was really, I was really going on instinct, and I picked people who were important to me, but also who were sort of figures who have thought and written a lot about death.
Let us begin in our conversation and talk about Susan Sontag. As you write, here is a woman who is greatly tested during her third bout with cancer. What is fascinating, in your opinion, about her story?
Well, one of the things, I had kind of chosen people with different styles of dying, and the interesting thing about her death is that she really did not believe she was going to die long after the evidence was clear. She really, really tried to fight this illness down to the bitter end. And because she had survived a very harrowing cancer in the 70s, you know, where the doctor said to her, you know, you have a 97% chance of dying, and she had survived, she sort of believed that she would be the exception, that she would be the one person to transcend this illness. Part of what was interesting about that to me is that she had written, in Illness as Metaphor, her famous book, kind of against the idea of using metaphorical thinking to apply to illness, against fantasy and all of our fantasies. And about, the book is really a call to think really rationally and clearly about illness. And this was something that, ironically, she was very unable to do at the end of her life. And so one of the things that was interesting about her death was just watching her kind of convictions and long-held thoughts collide with this emotional imperative.
The pictures that Annie Leibovitz took of her death are especially striking.
Yes.
And those were published a few years ago. Did that enter into your interest into her death at all?
I think so. Yes. I mean, it's interesting because those images were very controversial. She took very upsetting pictures of Sontag when she was extremely ill, and then after she died, even. And she really, a lot of the people around Sontag objected, including her son and many of her close friends, you know, were horrified by those images. And Leibowitz talks about, you know, what propelled her and why she did it. And I think her desire to record this moment, to sort of preserve it, is not unheard of. And I did find that those images incredibly fascinating. And I think, you know, it's something that people have always done. If you think about death masks in the Victorian era, or one of the other writers I write about, Maurice Sendak, sat down and drew the people he loved either before or right after they died. Also just desperate to sort of preserve that moment or capture it. And I think it's actually sort of an understandable impulse when you look at it.
Maurice Sendak is a very interesting story in the book, because he had been ill for so long, and even ill as a child, as you indicate, similar when you were ill as a child. With that said, was he expecting it?
Was he expecting his death?
Meaning, was it something that he felt was going, had always felt that it was soon?
He did. He was always very nervous that he was about to die, and he in fact had a heart attack very young, which sort of confirmed this belief that he was sort of right on the edge of death all the time. And so he did have a sort of feeling, you know, he was sort of intimate with the idea of death in a way that other people aren't so much. And it did consume his imagination. So much of his sort of famous children's books that people, you know, beloved and people think about are really suffused with the fear of dying or being eaten by a lion or being cooked into a cake or, you know, all of these things, or, you know, goblins carrying off an infant. There's a great deal of sort of violence and you know, basically death that he's working through in his drawings and in his writing, and I think he labored over this problem his entire life, and he definitely had a sort of hugely developed fear of death from childhood.
When photographs actually played in, he was looking for photographs of people who had died near him, correct?
Well, he drew the people around him, and when his partner of many decades died, he asked somebody to take a photograph of him when he died, right after he died, so that he could draw from that photograph. You know, essentially creating a kind of death mask in a way. And it was his way of processing the world, you know, to sort of draw it and to represent it in art. And that was, you know, kind of his way of managing and controlling the universe. And Updike, who I also write about, has a phrase that I really like, where he talks about writing as turning pain into honey. And I think a lot of the writers I'm looking at, in one way or another, take this really painful thing and try to turn it into art.
You write in the book about John Updike that when he gets a diagnosis that he is very ill, he immediately begins to write a poem.
Yes, it takes him about a day, but you know, in the hospital, he asks his wife for a scrap of paper and starts writing the poems that will be his really astonishing book, Endpoint, which are basically almost journalistically document what's happening to him. And most people under so much physical and kind of psychological duress would not be able to write on that level or, you know, on any level. And so it's really an amazing feat. And I actually saw the manuscripts of the poems, and if you look at the handwriting in the manuscripts, you can just sort of feel how hard it was for him to just even get those poems down on paper.
Did you know any of these writers before they passed?
I did not meet any of them, no.
So was there, how agreeable are people to, when you get this intimate and talk about those final days, how agreeable were family members in general to you in talking about that time of death?
The family members were largely incredibly generous with their time, and I was very nervous about approaching people and asking them to talk about this subject, but it wasn't, you know, it turned out not to be as hard as I thought, because people were really willing to do it. And I think in one way, part of it is that this is sort of a taboo subject, and when a parent dies or someone you love dies, you're not supposed to, you know, go on and on and on about it forever. And so in a way, the kind of socially acceptable thing is to stop talking about it at a certain point. And I think there's a hunger or desire to actually look at this subject or talk about it. And, you know, so in a way, it's kind of liberating to, you know, at least for some of the people I was talking to finally get to really discuss it. So I think, you know, I was very nervous about those interviews, but they ended up going very well. And I should, by the way, amend my answer, because I did, in fact, talk to James Salter before he died.
Yes.
And in my epilogue. And so I had originally set out to kind of discuss with an 89-year-old writer, you know, this issue, but then, you know, somewhere in the process before the book came out, he did also die. So I did actually extensively talk to him before he died.
And you talk about, and as you mentioned, it is the epilogue of the book, and you talk with him about the idea of dying, which at 89, again, was something that he was, in a way, preparing for, but also, as you mentioned, a writer who had certainly written about this topic many times.
Yes. Well, I feel like even more than writing about it, the sort of mood of all of his writing, even if he's writing about a love affair, is so elegiac. It's kind of, he's always writing about every moment as if it's about to be lost. And it's one of the things that makes his writing incredibly beautiful. But I felt in his work kind of an apprehension or a preoccupation with the ending, you know, even when he was a young man. Or a younger man. So he definitely was somebody who I was very interested to talk to about, you know, how he was thinking about death. And you know, in a certain way, he kind of, when I first started talking to him about it, he wasn't thinking about it. You know, he sort of said, I'm not thinking about dying. And I found that surprising. But then in the course of our conversation, it ended up that he sort of did have a lot to say.
Of these six great writers that you chronicle, did any of them, to your thinking, have an understanding of how their writing would live on?
Well, I think all of them had a hope that their writing would, you know, kind of move forward. And Salter certainly explicitly talks about, you know, our immortality is in pages, to paraphrase him, and Updike also, you know, he writes about actually reading his own writing after he dies. He has a sort of fantasy of that. He had a concept of his writing living on after him, but I would think all of them had a concept of their legacy or were interested in, you know, that idea of their writing moving forward.
The name of the book is The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End. The book is published by The Dial Press. Katie Roife, I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thanks so much.
Again, the title of the book is The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End. It's published by The Dial Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.